Hello, my name is Matt Truman, and you're listening to Theatre Voice, a performance podcast from the V&A. Back in 2014, I was sent along to an old disused pub in Ancoats, an area of Manchester that was once an industrial slum. Today, that part of town has gentrified. It's studded with restored brick warehouses and glassy apartments. The Victorian gangs that fought for this turf are long gone. But that night, this pub brought them back to life. There they were, dressed in shell suits and streetwear, armed with baseball bats and zombie knives. Prize fighters pummeled punch bags in the back room, wives wept in the loos, and a man in a pig mask strung someone up over a pool table. That show, Angel Meadow, was my first experience of Dublin's A New Productions, the collaboration between director Louise Lowe and visual artist Owen Boss. They make site-specific, immersive shows in the vein of Punch Drunk, only grounded in history and infused with a dreamlike, often dancerly quality. Their shows sometimes seem to raise ghosts. They bring a place's past back into being, be that the victims of the Arndale Centre bombing in On Corporation Street, the street fighters of Dublin's Easter Rising in these rooms, or the institutionalised women of the Magdalen Convent in Laundry. To my mind, Anew are one of the sharpest site-specific companies around. They're theatre makers with a strong sense of identity and a specific sense of their practice. They use theatre to bring a place back in touch with itself, and it's no surprise to learn in this interview with the critic Shirsha Anton that their roots lie in community theatre. They're returning to them this summer with a citywide event for the Manchester International Festival marking the centenary of the Peterloo Massacre. To talk about that, here are Louise Lowe and Owen Boss.
Myself and Owen have worked together for 15 years. And we've been working a lot. We met in college and doing a postgrad course in youth arts in Maynooth. And we fell out spectacularly on day one of the college course. And the question that was presented to us on that first day was, what is art, by our tutor.
I said, yeah, anything had the potential to be art, and it didn't need any set of kind of structures around it in order to make it art.
And thankfully it was day pre-iPads or computers or phones at a notebook, which I very uncharacteristically threw onto the floor in a moment of demonstrative angst, and said, well, is that art? And Owen said, it could be. And I said, but there's no intention behind it. There's nothing really to suggest what it's for. So I went home that day and I said to my best friend and housemate and Debbie, I said, look, it's going to be a long year. There's this guy in my class. I used an expletive that I won't repeat for the podcast. And it's going to be a very long year.
And I did the exact same thing. I went back to my best friend and pretty much said word for word what Louise said to her best friend.
I am delighted to report that Debbie and Owen are now happily married on their 10th wedding anniversary and have two beautiful children. And we've been working together ever since. And I suppose that's really important, because I suppose that, and I suppose our philosophy is all almost merged now, I suppose, in terms of intention and the capacity for anything to be art. And but I suppose, yeah, so I suppose that's kind of what started us talking to each other. And then at the end of that year, we were asked to pick somebody, as you are, in the group that might challenge your process or challenge your ideology. And we were to make a youth arts project, I suppose. It could be anything. It could have been in visual art, could be in sound, could be dance, could be anything. And I was working in Ballymun at the time with Rendabit Youth Theatre, and those young people that I'd been working with there for the previous 6 years had been living on the largest building site in Europe in terms of regeneration, and they'd only known it as a building site. So I wanted to continue working with them, and came to Owen and asked him if he'd like to join that journey, I suppose. So we made a project called Tumbledown Town in the summer of 2005, which involved those 26 young people coming with us on a journey in which to explore the regeneration, explore their lives in response to it. And I suppose our feeling about young people in art was very close, in terms of they were seeing them as young artists with a voice, and an important voice. The end of Tumbledown Town, it was presented that year as part of Dublin Fringe Festival, and it won the Spirit of the Fringe Award, which came with a commission. I don't know if we would have continued working together or not after that project. And also, we got a Breaking Ground Local Artist Commission Award for that project, which was Public Art Commission, which again was one of the first projects to challenge that theatre could have a value to the state. And the ephemerality of it was because up to that point, public art was statues on the side of roadside, big statues and sculptural pieces. So we proved that it could be a value, and it could be a value to a community. And that was brilliant. And then it won Spirit of the Fringe Award, which came with a commission, which involved us working together again the following year. And I suppose that's really where the momentum began. And over the next 3 or 4 years, we made a number of pieces with different communities of space, place and interest across that way. And then in 2007, maybe, roughly, we both went back to college. And what year did you go back to NCD?
2007, I think,
I think mine was similar. I went to Central in London, did an MA in directing and applied theatre, and Owen went off then to NCD, which is the National College of Art and Design here.
Our first production, one of the first productions we'd done was Basin, which was looking at Louise's kind of her family life in where she grew up, which was the Basin Park in the gatehouse there. We'd done a piece there, and then the next piece after that was this World's End Lane, which is the start of this Monto cycle. Linking back then to the history of the work we've already made with the communities we made them in, especially the work that was kind of based on reality and based on real events, based on
social histories,
real people's engagement with their lives. And so that foundation of actually making creative work about a real thing or a real event
was already there.
Was also, that fed into it as well. And we had a kind of like 5 years of previous experience of actually trying to engage with that. So I think that all
that kind of socially engaged practice was there. Inherently in both of us.
And even the narratives of real events.
Yeah, I think so.
And they were the most successful things that we had engaged with. Mm. Some things we had made that were fictitious and stuff, but I felt that the bedrock or the anchor of kind of making work about real events or real people kind of really kind of was really important to us and made the best type of work that we made.
I remember reading Brian Singleton writing about laundry and using Pierre Nora's phrase lieu de mémoire, and to describe that. And I remember thinking that applied to a lot of your work, that kind of site of memory and creating and recreating those sort of historical.
He calls it a prosaic memory in relation to her work, doesn't he, as well?
So I suppose you began to answer that there, but could we chat about that a little bit, about where that kind of focus on history and social history came from within your work, and how you came to that as quite a fertile source, in Basin? And was it one show that began it, or was it
I think it's ourselves, actually. I think it's inherent in us politically, socially, should I say. I think there's a I can only speak for myself in relation to that, I suppose, but in terms of looking at your family history in terms of politics and grandfather, all that stuff. Like, I suppose it was in us anyway, in terms of championing social issues, naturally. I think we both of us had a natural disposition to want to challenge and to disrupt and to change.
To look at inequality in the world, in our local areas.
Yeah, in ourselves, in our families, all of it. I think for me, growing up in the inner city and realising that art is this thing that happened for other people, or thinking that art was a thing that happened for other people. My whole life thinking that, I'm interested in it, I'm on the periphery of it, I'm standing outside it slightly, trying to go into art galleries and being refused because of how you look or how you sound, or not being able to afford to go to a theatre. All those things probably spurned me to think that art, we know now, of course, that, the UN rights of art and culture is an inherent one. But if you don't know that you don't have that right, then you don't know that you don't have it in the first place. So I suppose for me, very, very early on in my childhood, I would say, or teenage years, was that interest in art and the capacity for it to create an empathy or a deeper understanding of the world that we live in. And I suppose that's what would have inspired me to go and work, first of all, I suppose, within prison services, and then later on with youth theatres. And I've been working with community groups for maybe 15 years or 10 years, even prior to us working together. So it was always the foundation of what we did. But I think then collectively, it made us look at the capacity, with Tumble Down Town, even from the very beginning, of going, actually, this is the power to make people to understand and to give voice to people who don't have it. And in doing that, to create, to summon, to summon those voices and to create what is not a polarization of who gets to tell their story in the first place, and dare I say it, to incorporate things like class and gender politics inside of there in terms of social politics has fueled me my entire life.
Yeah, and I think not only was it the kind of end product of, say, Tumble Downtown, where you're looking at I think we went in with kind of the idea that it was past, present, future of these young people's lives and their creative response to that, but it's actually the process of actually making that work as well that fed into it, rather than just this end product.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, so that combined with two different art forms, a sense of injustice in the world, and the tenacity and stupidity, I think, to try and want to set up a company in what was the biggest recession the country's ever known, has spurned us from the beginning. And I suppose going back to Basin, I went back and turned the process of working with community groups onto myself. I was like, well, I've done that a lot now. So what would happen if I turned that in on myself? And my old family home was lying vacant in the Gate Lodge in 2009. And I could remember peering into the letterbox. My father had passed away 4 years previous to that. And our family, my mum had downsized. So our family furniture was all still inside. And I remember peering into the letterbox and going, God, what would happen if I turn now that process on myself? So I understand what it is that I'm asking of other people to do. And then that's what we made Basin about. And in a way, Basin was nearly there. We worked with brilliant writers, but then realised halfway through the process of working with brilliant writers, Gary Dogan and Jessica Traynor, but we didn't want them to fictionalise it. So it already created this friction or tension between what was made up and what wasn't. And I suppose then
it was a great piece of learning.
A huge learning point.
When I think back on that 10 years ago, that the actual site itself is a gate lodge in this small park in the city centre of Dublin. And we ended up dividing it in two. So there was the pieces that happened in
But that's
the gate
because
lodge.
We didn't want them to make
And then there was
stuff.
The pieces that happened outside, and stuff that happened outside was the fictional stuff that we,
as it needed to be.
That we had worked with the writers to produce, and then there was the stuff that happened inside, which was engaging with Louise's own personal history.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel right to bring what the writers had been writing into that house. It just,
and they'd started to write for the house. Yeah. And I remember just feeling really uncomfortable with it, going, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. And there's something about learning that in relation to yourself, first of all, that makes you really, really profoundly responsible for another people's stories later on, isn't it? Like when you discover that, you go, that didn't happen that way, or it didn't align itself in the right order or something, that it was about, that was a big, big learning curve, I think.
And then, so following on from Basin then, because I know your work does kind of tread that line between seeming documentary work and
almost dreamlike.
And yes, actually that's a really good word for it. So how overall have you kind of approached that practice of kind of creating some fictionalized representations? I mean, I'm looking over your head at the poster for The Lost O'Casey, but then seeing the other ones there that are more grounded.
But the
spaces.
Truth of it is, Sarah Morris, in relation to The Lost O'Casey, which is probably one of her more recent projects, worked for 7 months with local GPs and service users. So her incarnation of Nanny, even 100 years later from Sean O'Casey's, is based on real people.
Mm.
And Nanny, and the original Nanny is based on
is based on a real person. So Nanny was a real person that he was writing about. He writes about her actually exclusively in his own biography. So he can't see, he seems intoxicated by her, he can't let her go. So it's
a woman called Mile Millie.
So they are actually real. Now we could, you know, and I think it's about melding and merging those. So even what seems like a fictitious Sean O'Casey play, a 100-year-old child, actually is based in complete real. The real-life Nanny came to the Abbey Theatre on the opening night and created havoc because she wrecked the place because it was a temperance house. And not because she was afraid of the representation of herself, but she just was raging. She couldn't get a drink.
But even through our own research inside the World War One stuff, the 1916 stuff that we have produced, we would have delved into kind of hidden histories or forgotten histories within that. And I remember you going to see Play on the Stars and seeing images within that you're going, oh my God, that actually happened.
Yeah.
So a lot of what O'Casey was writing about was actually real life. And that, I think that has almost been forgotten, or people take, because it's been so long ago, or for whatever reason, or they're forgotten histories that people think it's fictitious. But I remember you coming out and talking about it and go,
yeah, I know that relationship. I know
North
what that
King
moment
Street Massacre
is.
Is actually what he's talking about here.
Yeah.
But nobody knows that anymore.
And we know that Jack Clitheroe was based on Sean Connery.
Yeah.
And the relationship he had with all, so you can look at it now and go, actually, I can I can pinpoint a lot of what O'Casey's writing about and talking about on real events and real people. And the more that I've got to know his own archive and working with the O'Casey estate, it's been quite interesting to see how that opens itself out. But I suppose the fundamental thing that came about, even from then, was trying to place questions at the centre of the work. So even whether it's those in those, and those hyper-real states become very important because they remind us, so very often we figured out earlier on that audiences were quite overwhelmed at what we were presenting them. And they needed those moments of respite or those moments of reminding that this is a play. So those hyper-real moments became very, very important in relation to allow audiences engage with it at their space and time and level. And we've never told people what to think through any of our work. I mean, as political as we might be, we've always tried to frame it that anybody can come and engage with it. So I remember, you know, lots of nuns coming to see Laundry and having conversations with them afterwards. And they were quite happy with the representation that was presented because they felt that it was fair mm-hmm. and that it was just and that it was equitable in terms of understanding the dynamic between the women and the survivors. And they were all survivors because those nuns were no less institutionalized than the women were in the Laundry. So I suppose, you know, we've always tried to frame it in whatever we're doing, that actually it can be viewed from different vantage points, no more so or less so than these rooms, where we created literally two different shows inside of itself. One from the perspective of the British soldier and British audiences, certainly for the remounting of it in Lift in London, yeah. We deliberately took audiences on two very different trails, split people up and allowed them when they came to come and have that conversation, because there's no right and wrong in history or in society or in politics, and people should just be free to make their own decisions about what they're... I think art should be complicated and contested and questioning and entertaining. Like that's the truth of it. It should be thrilling. It should be exciting. It should be magical, and it should feel like you're at the very centre of that, just holding on and making it in relation to our audiences all of the time is the thing that worries me most. Like, I always question, like, I'm sure actors get, especially new performers, I'm sure get very confused with me, because I'm like, oh, where am I now, meaning the audience? I always only ever see myself in relation to making work as the audience. So it's about building the journey and building the structures around whereby they can feel like they can be auteurs of their own experience, that they are the dramaturg, that they are the final piece of that bill that are essential to the creation of the artwork. And that's, in a way, we don't know what it's going to be until it's in front of people, because that's the moment that it gets fizzy, and that's the moment that it gets, that magic is that final bit of the communion is brought together in such a profound way, isn't it? Like,
oh yeah, and if we make... If
that's
we
what fuels to, me, I think. That's yeah, what fuels you, absolutely. And to keep making.
I think that if we make all those spaces and all those performances as real as possible, as real as we could possibly make them, and then we bring in surreal elements to those or make them hyper-real or whatever, that it does something to an audience member that's right at the centre of that. And if they're on their own and they're experiencing this, it can be a profound moment. Or they're being asked a question that's just for them.
But it allows them to
them.
Transcend it.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if you think about like the Lane Way and Boys Fall Street, where people are like, that felt too real. But actually, then going back it straight away into a car where a woman's body is tumbling down the windscreen, then it creates a moment whereby you're reminded again, this is a piece of art. Yeah. So it's about taking, because very often the work is happening inside real worlds or real streets or real places, whereby you can think, is this part of the show? Is this not part of the show? What's happening? And audiences describe that work as being inside a live film. And then to remind them again, this is a piece of art and you're safe inside it, that you can stand back and judge. And it's about, you know, immersing audiences in a place whereby they can participate as much as they want or not. They can completely be voyeurs inside that work, and they could have that power. That before, because very often there's an unevenness in immersive work that I see that I don't like, whereby the performer holds all the power. You know, they know what's next, and the artwork has been created with that in mind, and it's always just feels slightly disingenuous to me when I'm participating in it and when I'm going to see it, that I think, oh, I'm either, you know, I just feel like I don't matter to whatever's happening. And suddenly if you change the dynamic where that paradigm shifts, and you're allowed to have that moment whereby I can choose to do that or not, I can answer the phone or not, the work should still happen around you, but actually the performer in that moment really does need something from me.
Absolutely.
And whether it's to take a memory of a bobbin or a piece of soap from a laundry, or, you know, there's very often it gives them things to take away as well.
That their presence really matters.
Fundamentally, that's what the work is about. It's making not, them feel
we're
that.
Not making documentary. Yeah. We're making creative response to a real event. So
yeah.
You can have those moments.
We're making a piece of art.
Yeah.
So. And it allows for them to stand out of it, to transcend it, to not be, yeah.
And if it's successful, I always find that it stays with the audience for about an hour after they leave, as they travel home. So you can often see in people maybe you know that are still kind of dealing with how the work integrated within the real world, and that how they see the real world is still at that hyper real stage, that they might be traveling home on the train and are kind of tweeting about it or whatever, and they're still kind of going, oh, is this show still going on?
Yeah.
And I think that when you see that, it's like, oh, that's really key, because you're still questioning, you're still having those questions posed in your own head even after the show is finished. And I think that for me is when it really works really well.
For your 10th anniversary, you've put together a retrospective kind of photography exhibition in the Una Young Gallery. And I'm kind of curious as to what the process of creating that kind of collection of artefacts from your performance was like for you.
We've been very lucky over those 10 years to have worked with Pat Redmond on multiple projects. So
who's
Pat
a
Redmond's a photographer, yeah. And he documents film processes and theatre processes. So, and we've worked with Pat Redmond since Tumble Down Town.
Very,
actually,
very beginning.
He was brought in by the commissioning body Breaking Ground to actually document Tumble Down Town. So we started a relationship with him there and have continued that relationship till now. And he's our first guy that we really go to in order to capture our work. And he just responds to our work really, really well and captures it so wonderfully. So it was just great to go back to Pat and go, are you interested in doing this retrospective exhibition of looking back on all the work we have we've made over the past 10 years? And so I sat down with Pat over a number of weeks, and we went through thousands and thousands of photographs. Look, and then on the night of the opening, we put out invitations to all the people that had worked with us, and so many people turned up. Louise said it was like being at your own funeral.
It was the strangest experience we can ever
had. It was
a
wonderful, wonderful celebration, and yeah, it was just, there was a lot of kind of positive, good vibes in the room, a lot of love in the room. It was actually a wonderful night, and it was just,
I think it's
really
because
nice
the work is by everybody. It's by
yeah.
all those artists who've contributed their time, energy, skill, talent, souls to the work that, like they invest so much all of the time in, and so much energy and so much of themselves, because we just set provocations and themes, and they are the people who make it with us. Like
yeah.
it's not by anybody, because it's by everybody. The title being That Was Us was really
yeah.
important, because that was us. It was all of us. And to watch their care for the work. And I think I can speak for them and lots of the artists who work for us to say there's a different engagement when they work with us on a project, because they do feel ownership.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of the work, and they rightly feel ownership
yeah.
of the work. It's their work, but it's a different engagement. Even our stage managers talk about it being very different. That their opinion of the art is important, and I think that changes everything.
And how the
art
is being made.
If the room is equal and there's an equilibrium, that everybody's opinion is valid. If we're like a family,
yeah,
you know. And I think there's been such a shorthand built over years, despite the fact that every single project we try and bring new artists in. Because I think that challenges our methodology and challenges how we make work. I think there's been not one project where we've actually gone with the same
yeah.
status quo, which is great. But there's also every time alongside that, there's been artists and designers and stage managers and everybody who's been involved in the creative process have come at it with developing a shorthand understanding of the rhythm of the work and the how it's made and the why it's made. And I think we're in a really, really fortunate place in that we have built such a bank of incredible collaborators.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, alongside developing technology which enables us to tell the work better, has been really, really important. So in the last 10 years, we've worked with radio frequency identification technology, which is RFID, and it's very simple in its thought. It's like being scanned like a supermarket grocery, you know, scanning machine, in that we can capture where the audience are, and the audience are responsible. Nobody's operating the sound and lights very often for the show. It's been operated in real time by the audience, which again creates more of that like authorship, or they choose to sit down in a chair and that triggers the sound and lights and cues an actor. Or, you know, there's a blackout created on a tiny little mini Arduino computer on the tip of a pen, or there's just different ways of thinking about how technology has also been grown alongside the practice, and a family of contributors are growing, and then there's new people coming in every time. It's a really genuinely exciting place to be, every project, isn't it? Like, it's terrifying, but it's
terrifying but exciting.
So I suppose one of your projects this year is with the Manchester International Festival, and could you tell us a little bit about developing that work then? Obviously it's a new venture entirely.
Sure. Apparently we are the first Irish company to ever participate in the festival, which is extraordinary. And the festival is such a world-renowned festival of ideas and collaborations. And I started a conversation many years ago with John McGrath, actually, when he was with Contact, probably originally, and then on to his stewardship of the National Theatre of Wales, and then forwarding that then into Manchester International Festival. And I suppose those I think that's really important to kind of just acknowledge that those collaborations and invitations very often don't come at you out of the blue. They're developed over years of relationship building and conversations just about art. And then we went through various different ones. And I think Manchester International Festival works best when John is bringing together people he thinks would never have met each other. And I think it's an extraordinary testament to him and his vision. So he decided to partner us for this project with the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, with a poet called Michael Simmons Roberts and a composer called Emily Howard. And he brought us all together to have a series of discussions in Manchester International Festival HQ to talk about what would happen if we were to make something in response to Peterloo, which is a massacre that happened, you know, 250 years ago this year, is thought to be the birthplace of democracy and protest. And what would happen if we tried to align ourselves with a poet, a composer, and an orchestra, and a city? And that really was the set of his provocations to go, well, what might that be? And I remember we walked through the library atrium, which is a connecting glass building between the library buildings now in St. Peter's Square, which is on site of where it happened. And there was these tiny little red lights in the ground representing 15 people who had died on that day. And I was like wondering, going, where did they come from? Like, you know, they're connected forever now in terms of history. We have engaged with a series of creative leaders and artists across the city, who work there and who are exceptional artists of their own kind, like, you know, Keisha Thompson and Danny Faye and, you know, Hafsa Bazir, and amazing artists. Who am I leaving out there?
Yeah, Tasha Whittle
and,
Jim and Annie from Triple.com.
Yeah, so we've been really amazing to work with six Manchester-based artists who are working with community groups there, and Billy Cowan, playwright, and to try and see, well, what would it take to get you to the streets now? So it's not that we're reenacting Peterloo, but it's about going, what would spurn you to protest today?
You were saying about working with local artists who are the experts in the area, and how have you guys found it working in an area, in a different area to your usual kind of stomping ground? I'd imagine with your Dublin work, there was a sense of kind of collective memory, even if it was memories you hadn't necessarily lived through yourself. Is there a difference in your practice?
There is a difference. Abroad? There is, absolutely, yeah. And I think the difference is if you hear that the experts that you're building around you are ones that you might know where to go toward. And that's
very... We
have
a cultural knowledge here in Dublin of kind of where to look, who to ask. Yeah. And
but still considering them to be the expert in what we're doing.
Oh, absolutely.
So we've always responded in that way, whether it's moving into the block of flats that we worked in for Lost O'Casey while those residents were moving out. They were the experts. It's their worlds. We're often moving into the worlds that people live in. Now, there is an understanding of what that is in Dublin, or where to go to, as you said. But across abroad, it's a different buzz because you've got to go, I don't understand this. So you find those experts who do, and then, but here's the really interesting thing. That distance allows me to be ignorant and to ask questions that I wouldn't get away with asking if I was from there. And I think that's really exciting, you know, and to work across different cultural zones. I had one of the most amazing conversations this morning with Hafsa Bazir, who's making a piece of working with the Muslim Chai community, whom I know nothing about, and who are probably, in terms of representation and public, you know, public agency, are the least represented body, cultural body in Manchester in terms of public transport. So we've been talking about how women from these particular communities are the most targeted for hate crimes on the tram system, for example. And what we're proposing is to take over the tram system with a lot of these women, who are suddenly going to have their voices, these unheard voices being presented for the first time. But there's lots of cultural questions about permissions and communities and how it can work and how they can't work until after Ramadan, and how those permissions are engaged and how those real voices may or may not be recorded, how they need to be presented, what we need to engage with Transport for Greater Manchester, how safe they are standing at a tram stop, what the cultural implication of them protesting is, what that agency is, all those things that I don't understand on my day-to-day basis because I am not a Muslim woman living in Manchester. But actually, Hafsa is. And her working from her own body of knowledge and understanding and lived experiences to then place it with these women to bring these protest songs that are normally very privately sung songs into a public realm is going to be an extraordinary moment. But I don't know how we're going to actually achieve that because there's so much cultural indicators and things that need to be in place to allow that to happen to the best way that it can. So you're learning all the time and you're being guided and being pushed and provoked. And then another community group that we're working with is a series of paramedics and doctors or, you know, and across there, you know, there's...
It's a group of young people as well. We're working with from young girls from Salford. And again, it's similar, like, what would take it to
take them to the streets?
Yeah, what would it take to get them out on the streets? And that particular group was formed after the Brexit vote. So young people felt that they didn't have any agency at the time because they weren't able to vote, so they couldn't affect what would eventually really impact on their
and
lives.
And one of the central slogans during Peterloo itself was, as people were coming towards the city, 60,000 people came onto the city that day, and they said, this is who we are. So that's become a central questioning to all those groups that go, well, who are you? We may not be the expert in those, but we can identify who are best placed to work with those experts, and the experts being the communities themselves.
And we've also previously made two pieces of work in Manchester. So we made on Corporation Street in 2016 and Angel Meadow in 2014. So the actual space or
and
the
Torch
city
just
itself.
Outside Manchester.
Yeah,
well.
In Torch, which was last year, 2018, in St. Helens. So it's not an unfamiliar place unfamiliar territory.
With 10 very successful years under your belt, what do you have in mind for the future? What's your vision for the company?
I think we're getting braver and bolder. I think for 10 years we've decided to just pull apart those modes of transmission a little bit more and to focus on the visual art elements of the work. It's what we very deliberately decided last year and going, it's somehow been swamped or swallowed. Mm. We're known as a theatre company, but the truth is that we're not just a theatre company.
It's the two art forms. It's the kind of combination of those two art forms. So, and I think I think we've gained a lot of confidence over the last 10 years.
And maybe it is about that we've built a language to help support what that is, probably. And there is a confidence, I think, and
that doesn't mean that things won't fail or
we won't fail spectacularly. That's
okay.
Frequently.
Like,
and we'll again, and we'll learn from those things and scrape ourselves up and go again. And you have to. And you have to be open to those failures as much as you're open to the moments that you can. But it's nothing more exciting than starting that new project. That's a feeling of
terror.
Holding the breath and the roller coaster just taking over. I suppose our plans for the next number of years are really exciting, I'm glad to say. I know we can't talk a lot about it, but it's again...
5 years planned?
We've up to 2023 planned, and we are starting work on developing those pieces of work already. There's one piece of work that will be a 3-year partnership with another company. And then there's lots of different international conversations happening even further afield.
Yeah. In a similar way to the conversations that we had with John McGrath.
They're building over years.
That's what happened. You start those conversations a year ago, and in 4 years' time, 3 years' time, something hopefully will...
You're knee-deep with Quakefoot, knee-deep in MIF,
yeah.
And yet we're still planning for it for way on, way away.
Yeah.
This Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, for hundreds of recordings by some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Shisha Anton and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.